Thank you very much, Rabbi Eisenberg, and good evening to everybody. It's a tremendous schus, a tremendous privilege to be here. I want to thank all the sponsors and the underwriters of this event and the religious Zionists of Chicago organization, which does such important work and which really deserves community support to be able to further its mission on behalf of not only the Chicago community, but really all of Klal Yisrael. The topic of theocracy versus democracy in the context of the modern state of Israel is a very timely one. It's a topic that is being written about in the Jerusalem Post and is being discussed in many places, including the Knesset floor, particularly in light of recent legislation that was proposed by Prime Minister Netanyahu that would establish Israel as a Jewish nation state, and somehow this has raised the ire of many, both within Israel and outside of Israel, that somehow this formulation may potentially compromise the democratic nature of the state of Israel. And I want to talk about that a little bit. And more generally, I want to talk about the conception of government that we have from a Torah perspective with respect to the state of Israel. So first of all, I will note that the Rambam, in his seminal work, the Yad Chazaka, the Mishneh Torah, when talking about the miracle of Hanukkah, which of course is right around the corner, states that one of the great accomplishments of the Chashmonaim, in addition to recapturing the Beis HaMikdash, and in addition to their unlikely military victory over the Yevanim, over the Syrian Greeks, one of their great achievements was that as a result of their battle, Chazor Malchus LeYisrael Yeser HaMasayim Shona, they were able to prolong the Jewish sovereignty in the state of Israel during the Second Temple period for an additional 200 years. And the Rambam considers this accomplishment of being able to preserve and prolong the Jewish sovereignty in Eretz Yisrael to be itself worthy of celebration and to be counted as one of the aspects of the Hanukkah holiday that we celebrate. Hence, it is a most apropos topic for this evening on the advent of Hanukkah to speak about the nature of Jewish sovereignty in Eretz Yisrael. Rav Yosef Dov Soloveitchik famously explained that there is a special status of Klal Yisrael, of the Jewish people, that pertains only to those Jews who are actually living in Eretz Yisrael. The Rav was also very careful to refer to the state of Israel as Eretz Yisrael, as opposed to Israel, sometimes I think citing the comment of the Satmar Rebbe, who quoted the Pasuk in Yirmiyahu, Alma Avda Haaretz Al Azvam Es Torasi. How did the Aretz disappear? Because they abandoned the Torah, so somehow Eretz Yisrael just became Israel. So we do view Eretz Yisrael in a particularly holy and sacred light, and he would refer to it as such. And the Rav said that those who live in Eretz Yisrael are the only ones, the only members of the Jewish people who are worthy of being counted, who have a vote when it comes to questions such as sanctifying the new month, when it used to be sanctified through witnesses who would observe the new moon, or even questions of declaring a leap year of Ibur Hashanah, as well as the only place where smicha could properly be conferred. This is before the creation of Yeshiva University and a Hebrew Theological College. So the Rav felt along these same lines that Jews who live in the diaspora really have no standing to make political judgments either with respect to what goes on in Eretz Yisrael. So therefore, everything that I'm going to say tonight is in the category of reflections rather than actual judgments. Notwithstanding the fact that one of my cousins who actually grew up here in Chicago is married to Moshe Feiglin, who is a prominent member of the Likud party, who for all we know may one day actually become a prime minister. Nonetheless, I will try to stay out of the expression of any personal opinions. So, first what I'd like to do is to discuss the current political landscape. Then I'd like to discuss the Torah ideal. And finally, describe the classic pitfalls that arise in connection with the clash between the Torah ideals and reality, and the way to pursue our aspirations and contend with the pitfalls that do arise in the modern-day climate of the state of Israel. In Israel's declaration of independence, which is commonly referred to as its Declaration of Independence, they actually neglected to give it a heading or a title, unlike the American Declaration of Independence, which actually says at least declaration on it. This doesn't say anything on it. But in the document that we call Israel's Declaration of Independence, which looks like this.
Oh, sure.
Right, okay. There's also, you know, the fancy, you know, form that they have with the colors and everything and the pictures on it, but this is the original document. So in that document, the word Yehudi, Yehayehudim, and even Medinata Yehudit, the state of the Jewish people, appears no fewer than 20 times in the course of the declaration. And the reference to the establishment of a Medinat Yehudit, of a Jewish state, appears at least 5 times. And in fact, the main paragraph, which is written in bold, I assume it's the main one because it's the only one completely in bold, which is in the declaration, reads, Lefikach niskansanu anu chaverei moetzet ha'am, we the representatives of the people have gathered together, nitzigei ha'yishuva ivri, those who represent the Hebrew settlements, Ve'atnuat Zionit, and the movement of Zionism, B'yom Siyum HaMandate HaBriti, this last day of the British Mandate, Al Eretz Yisrael, V'tokev Zkutenu HaTivit V'Historit, and based on the power of our legitimate claim to the land, which is a natural historical claim, V'Yisod HaKlatat HaTzarat HaUmimot, and based on the resolution of the United Nations, Anu Machrizim Bizot, we are announcing and declaring through this document Al Hakamat Medina Yehudit Be'eretz Yisrael, on the establishment of a Jewish state in Eretz Yisrael, He Medinat Yisrael, that is what is going to be known as Medinat Yisrael. So this was not just some ploy that Benjamin Netanyahu came up with a couple of weeks ago. This is very clearly and unmistakably stated in the charter document of Medinat Yisrael, which was adopted on May 14th, 1948, which also happened to coincide with Hei Iyar, also known as Yom HaAtzmaut, and also known as the birthday of my son Yamin. It was not until 1994, in the Basic Law of Human Dignity that was passed by the Israeli parliament, that Israel was identified as a Jewish and democratic state. The word democratic, whatever the Hebrew translation would be, does not appear to actually be included in the original Declaration of Independence, although nobody is opposed to it, And nobody denies the fact that Israel was established, in fact, as a democratic state. And this terminology of Israel being a Jewish and democratic state was not particularly challenged. It also wasn't particularly clear. It has spawned much discussion with radicals from both sides of the spectrum, both from the far left and the far right, arguing that Israel can't exist both as a Jewish state and as a democracy. Those on the far right would say it should only be defined as a Jewish state, and those on the far left would say it should only be described as a democracy. But with many moderates, including Ruth Gavison, who's a prominent professor of human rights at Hebrew University, arguing very forcibly that there is no contradiction, and you have many nation states that have a particular national affiliation of a particular people, a particular religion, and that are nonetheless democratic in nature. But what caused many to have consternation about Netanyahu's new bill was that the fact that, in contrast with the basic law of human dignity, which seemed to give equal importance to Israel being both a Jewish and democratic state, Netanyahu's proposed legislation focuses mainly on Israel being a Jewish nation state, and in the opinion of some, creates at least the appearance and perception that democracy is being pushed into a secondary or subordinate position. So one of the real questions is whether appearances matter. So I suppose the answer is that appearances matter when they're really just appearances. There's nothing really in the legislation that changes the reality of how Israel operates. But the question simply is, how should Israel present itself at this time? What is the right timing of legislation of this sort if it really would buttress the claims of those who argue that Israel is an apartheid state and inflammatory accusations of that sort? It's important, obviously, that the state of Israel always calibrate its actions carefully in order to ensure that it bring about both the notion of sanctifying the name of God, of being Mekadesh Shem Shemayim, and also serving as an Or La'amim, as the Navi, the prophet Yeshayahu, states on a couple of occasions that one of our functions in this universe, whatever we do, whether in the diaspora or whether running a sovereign state, is to be L'or Amim, is to be a light unto the nations and to conduct ourselves in a fashion which is beyond reproach. But none of this has anything to do with theocracy. Mostly it has to do with politics. Politics versus democracy is, of course, in perennial tension, even in this country, and I don't seek to resolve that particular conflict. But once we're on the subject of theocracy and democracy, it's probably useful to define terms. So I took the measure of opening up my handy-dandy Oxford Dictionary and checking to see what, in fact, these terms really mean. So theocracy is a system of government in which priests rule in the name of God. So this actually works very well for the Chashmonaim, because the Chashmonaim were priests, they were Kohanim, and they ruled the kingdom of Israel for a couple of hundred years after the miracle of Hanukkah. It would also work very well, since I'm a Kohen, if I took over the state of Israel as prime minister, but I don't aspire to. But that is theocracy. Now, democracy is a form of government in which people can vote for representation, for different people to serve as their representatives, to govern the country on their behalf. Now, I'm not really sure if these two forms of government are reconcilable, but it doesn't really matter, because this doesn't truly describe the state of Israel. the leaders who are elected through their parties to govern the people have no direct line to the divine. Nor, for that matter, as far as I know, do they claim to have a direct line to the divine. That would be the province of the Gedolim with Das Torah. But the Gedolim with Das Torah have, in actuality, no binding authority in the state of Israel. Even Rav Shach and Rav Elyashiv were not actually elected. There were lots and lots of acolytes who followed them and who hung on to their every word, but they were not, nor did they ever presume to be sovereign rulers of the state of Israel. So technically, Israel is neither a theocracy nor a democracy, but rather a parliamentary democracy, which means that there are parties that are voted for, and those parties have a list of different individuals who are going to serve in posts based on the number of votes that they receive. But to give a lecture on the nature and the underpinnings of a parliamentary democracy would be way too boring. So therefore, I'm going to move on to something else, which is what in fact is the Torah ideal with respect to our role living in Eretz Yisrael. So most of us are familiar with the first Rashi in the Torah. First Rashi in the Torah asks a question, which is, Amar Rabbi Yitzchak lo hayatzorech lahaskil es haTorah ela min b'chodesh hazeh lachem. Rabbi Yitzchak says that the Torah didn't have to tell us all of these really fascinating stories in Sefer Bereishis. It could have started with just the mitzvos that we have to know about and observe. But the reason why Hashem decided to tell us all these stories is because Koach Ma'asav Yigid Li Amo L'Seis Lehem Nachalas Goyim, that Hashem wanted to explain the process by which He made promises, covenantal promises, to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob, that He would give to us the land of Israel and that it would belong to us. So that if anybody asked us, what right do you have to the state of Israel? We would say, just take a look in Sefer Bereishis, take a look in the Torah, and this explains everything that you need to know. Have a good day. So that is really the Torah perspective. But the next part of the equation is that it doesn't end there, because the Torah, in fact, doesn't only give us Sefer Bereishis, but it gives us everything that follows thereafter. Meaning what? Meaning that the purpose of our having the land of Israel is to perform mitzvot, is to actually perform the Torah and all of the commandments of the Torah in the land of Israel. This is best captured, I think, by the famous Medrash that asks, Mipnei ma nisave Moshe Rabbeinu likanes la'aretz? Why did Moshe Rabbeinu desire so fervently to enter into the land of Israel? V'chi le'achol mipirya, o lispoa mituva? Was it just to say alamichya? Was it just so that he could enjoy the fruit and be satiated from the produce of the land? Hutzarech? No! Elakach amar Moshe. Rather, what Moshe Rabbeinu said is, Habe mitzvos nitzavu Yisrael al yadi. There are so many mitzvos that were given over to the Jewish people through myself, Ve'eno miskaimos ela ba'aretz, and they can only be fulfilled properly in the land of Israel. Ekanes ani kedei sheyiskaimu kulon al yadi. The main reason I want to enter into the land is so that all of the mitzvos can be performed through me directly, and that I can actually live according to the Torah that I have taught the people. So when we think about the ideal of what it means to live in Israel, the ideal is it's about keeping Shemitah, which is being observed this year. In fact, the Torah tells us that because the people didn't keep Shemitah properly, that's why we were kicked out of Israel for the number of years that corresponded to the Shemitahs that we didn't keep. Tirtzos Saharetz, Es Shab Soser. That this is the ideal when we think about the land of Israel. It is for the sake of keeping the mitzvot. But this is not per se a governmental obligation. It's a personal obligation and perspective that is relevant to each and every Jewish individual. However, it also affects the way that we view sovereignty and what it means in the state of Israel. The Torah tells us that Som tasim alecha melech, there's a commandment to appoint a king. The Jewish king carries with him at all times what? A Sefer Torah, the scroll of Torah, to remind him that he is subject to the authority of the Torah and that his kingship is premised upon that authority. In fact, the Ran, in a famous drasha of the Drashos Haran of Nissen Gerundi, rule says that the king in particular was bidden to carry the Sefer Torah with him at all times to remind him that despite the fact that a king has special prerogatives and has special kingly powers that might be in addition to normal Jewish jurisprudence, like with respect to punishing criminals and the like, nonetheless he has to remember at all times that he is subject to the precepts of the divine. Leman yilmad liyiras Hashem elokav, so that he will always learn to fear God, lishmor es kol divrei Torah hazos, to keep and fulfill all of the precepts of the Torah. Now, the Netziv, Rav Naftali Tzvi Bolin, the Rosh Yeshiva of Volozhin, writes in his commentary to the Torah that this is not an obligatory mitzvah per se to appoint a king. The people have to want this type of rule. They have to be interested in having this type of a sovereign who is going to be in power, who's going to be governed and to govern in accordance with the laws of the Torah. Otherwise, if somebody assumes that mantle, that position, and exerts that authority when the people don't want it, then it could really endanger what he calls the kiyum hachevra, the stability of society. The people have to be prepared, he writes in his words, lisbol ol hamelech, to be able to bear the yoke of the king in terms of the king exercising this type of religious sovereign authority. At the same time, we're also told in Tanakh, in the Bible, about the story of Shmuel, the judge, who was approached by the people, who said, we would love to have a king. Simu lanu melech l'shaftenu kechol ha-goyim. Appoint a king, but not a king who's going to be one of these guys walking around with the Sefer Torah. Now, that's not what we want. We want a king who's going to be like the prime minister and the king of all the other nations who go to the United Nations conferences and stuff like that. And he's going to look and sound and act like everybody else. So this was also no good. This was something that was frowned upon by Shmuel, the judge, who said that this is not at all respectful to the mission of the Torah or to God himself. And this type of a king, as explained by the Ran in his Drashos, is not what the Torah commands us to have. If we're going to have a king, if we're going to have a sovereign state, it's supposed to be based on the desire of the people to live lives according to the Torah. This is why when Medinat Yisrael was established and the court system and legal system that was put into place was based not on Torah law, but on British law and Turkish law and the combination of other legal systems that were not actually premised in Torah law, this caused an outcry from the reigning rabbinic leaders at the time, including the Chazon Ish, including the chief rabbi, the first Ashkenazic chief rabbi of Israel, Rav Yitzchak Isaac Halevi Herzog, and including Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank, who all argued that one of the main purposes of having a Jewish state is a state which does not only represent the Jewishness culturally of its citizens, but also the Judaism of its citizens and of its great heritage. In fact, even the Declaration of Independence, which some have argued is really focused more on Jewishness than Judaism, makes reference to the eternal book of books. In one of the first paragraph, really the very first paragraph, saying that one of the great marks of the Jewish heritage is that we brought to the world a Sefer HaSfarim HaNitzchi, the eternal book of books, obviously making reference to the Torah, making reference to the Bible. This is an integral part of the Jewish character of the state. Now, Rav Soloveitchik expressed this same tension between the ideal of what's supposed to be, but at the same time being sensitive to what the people are ready to accept upon themselves in the context of the very institution of the Rabbanut. The chief rabbinate was established already under the British mandate to be in charge of matters of marriage and divorce and personal status relating to the Jewish nation. When Medinat Yisrael was formed with an Israeli parliament, the decision was made at that time to, quote-unquote, maintain the status quo, that the Rabbanut would be left in place and would continue to enjoy the same authority as an arm of the government with respect to these various areas. And the Rabbanut has continued to enjoy, or at least, even if it's not always enjoyable, to exercise this jurisdiction up until the present time. But at the same time, Rav Soloveitchik recognized that there was a built-in tension, if not everybody appreciated this jurisdiction of the Rabbanut. So in a letter that the Rav wrote to Rav Shlomo Zalman Shragai, who was a prominent leader in the Mizrahi movement for half a century and was the mayor of Jerusalem in the early 1950s, the Rav wrote that he did not think that religious legislation per se would bring redemption to those who were not already religiously committed. He said that the only type of approach that could really bring redemption to the Jewish people would be educational and spiritual efforts to bring people closer. His feeling, however, was that the authority that the Rabbanut already had was not coercive in nature and was not really against the will of the people, because he said that if the leftist-leaning or secular authorities who formed or who were major players in forming the state of Israel really didn't want to have this rabbinic authority, then they would not have allowed it to persist. And that even though they might have been resentful, sometimes you might be resentful of something that you know is really good for you. And he felt that Ben-Gurion, Mapai, and all of the secularists really felt deep down that maintaining the Jewish character of the state religiously was good for them. And that's the reason that they made the concessions that they made. Otherwise, they could have formed their government and done quite well, said Rav Soloveitchik, even without Mizrahi. He was not referring to the RZC, which of course is indispensable. Now, this same sentiment was echoed by Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, who wrote that in his opinion, even though strictly speaking, according to traditional Jewish law, a Jewish sovereign would be allowed and empowered to engage even in coercive measures to mandate religious practice, he felt that these days, nowadays, coercion is no longer a feasible and justifiable modus operandi. Now more than ever, our main thrust, wrote Rav Lichtenstein, must be educational. However, at the same time, having a viable Rabbanut in place is, in fact, absolutely necessary to preserve the Jewish character of the state. And he writes, if the institution did not exist, it would have to be invented. That it is that important for the Jewish people, because we need it as a visible symbol of the state's link to traditional Judaism. Nonetheless, he adds, but a rabbanut, these are his words, not mine, but a rabbanut with a leaner self-image and less grandiloquent tone would be healthier. I remember a number of years ago when the Rabbanut HaRashit was becoming more opinionated about their acceptance or rejection of conversions performed outside of the State of Israel and wanted to have tighter controls over the way things are done outside of Israel. One rabbi commented about the chief rabbi at the time that who does he think he is? The Pope? So Rav Aharon distinguishes between what he calls the ideal, the normative, and the tactical, and he believes that we need to focus on the third approach, the tactical, what is really the best way to inspire people and to bring more Jews, both within Israel and outside of Israel, to develop a love of their Yiddishkeit. But at the same time, with respect to the religious leadership, in whatever form it manifests itself, it's very clear from traditional Jewish sources that it needs to be pristine and unaffected by governmental intervention. In fact, Rav Soloveitchik's main reason for rejecting the candidacy of a chief rabbinate position in Israel was that he was afraid that his authority would not be unfettered and that he would be a pawn of the government to do their bidding, and therefore would sacrifice his religious autonomy. In fact, the Ramban, Nachmanides, in his commentary to the Torah, speaking of Hanukkah yet again, felt that the Chashmonaim were not perfect in every single way. And he asked the question, why is it that the Mishnayos don't really spend significant time talking about Neis Chanukah, the Chashmonaim? It's something you have to really search for in the Gemara, and it's hidden somewhere in Maseches Shabbos, in the Perek, in the chapter that deals with lighting candles on Shabbos. There's a section folded in the middle about the holiday of Chanukah. Why is it sort of this hidden holiday? And he says, that's because the rabbis were angry at the Chashmonaim. And why were they angry at the Chashmonaim? Precisely because of the fact that they usurped authority that did not belong to them. The Chashmonaim represented the family of the Kohen Gadol. They were the spiritual leaders of the people. The Kohanim, the spiritual leaders of the people, are not supposed to assume the Malchus, the monarchy. Why is that? Because it compromises their ability to be purely spiritual minded in terms of doing the Avodas Hashem, of doing the service of their Creator. So in this sense, the Torah ideal very much mandates a separation between the spiritual leadership on the one hand and the political leadership on the other hand. So if the country of Medinat Israel is not ready yet for Malchus, for sovereignty, which is run according to the Torah, according to the precepts of the Sefer Torah that the king ideally is supposed to walk around with, then at the very least, the Torah leadership and the religious authorities in the State of Israel need to be able to conduct themselves according to Torah and without pressure from legislation or from political forces. This point is underscored by the commentary, the Maharsha, when the Maharsha talks about the gerrymandering of the Mizbeach, of the area of the altar in the Beis HaMikdash, that the Beis HaMikdash area was allocated to the tribe of Binyamin, which was viewed as a very spiritual tribe. But the kingdom was allocated, of course, to the tribe of Yehuda, the tribe of Judah. And the tribe of Judah, therefore, had a certain allocation in the Beis HaMikdash area. And their allocation went up until the Mizbeach, up until where the altar was. In fact, it included the southeast portion of the altar. So because of the fact that the altar itself, the holy altar, was supposed to be completely pristine and unaffected by politics, the altar was in the portion of Binyamin. But what do you do with the southeast section? So the base of the altar was removed for the southeast section. The southeast section does not have a base. And that is in order, explains the Maharshah, that the Keser Malchus, the crown of the monarchy, and the Keser Kehuna, and the crown of the spiritual leadership, be completely separated from each other. So there not be any kind of untoward influence coming from political pressures and political forces upon the spiritual leadership of the land. So what happens when there is a tension between the political leadership and the spiritual leadership? So the Talmud gives two striking examples of what happens when there is a tension. And both of them, going back to the paradigm of the Chashmonaim, involve a king who was later on in the dynasty of the Chashmonaim after they had already been significantly diminished in terms of their religious fervor and their high spiritual ideals. And this king's name was Yanai HaMelech. And it's very instructive that the stories are told about Yanai HaMelech because it serves to buttress the assertion of the Ramban that there was something ill-advised about the Chashmonaim taking over the kingdom. Maybe they were stretching their authority beyond where it really belonged, leading to all kinds of conflicts and confusion. So in one story, Yanai HaMelech had a servant who was accused of committing murder. And since it was the servant of Yanai HaMelech himself was summoned to appear before the great Sanhedrin by none other than his brother-in-law, Shimon ben Shetach, who was the head of the Sanhedrin. And Shimon ben Shetach said to Yanai, if you're going to testify in front of the Sanhedrin, you have to stand up. And Yanai said, I'm not standing up. I'm the king. And Shimon ben Shetach said, well, you're testifying in front of God. You have to stand up. And Yanai said, I'm the king. I'm not standing up. I'm not going to stand up unless the other members of the Sanhedrin, who are not my brother-in-law and whom I could easily kill, unless they tell me that I have to stand up. And none of them had the gumption under the circumstances to tell Yanai HaMelech to stand up. Gabriel the angel got so angry that he killed everybody. And this is the story as it is told in the Talmud. And after that, they made a decree that kings will no longer be called to testify in front of the Sanhedrin. Now, was this an ideal decree? No. It was a concession to a less than ideal situation because the kings couldn't be trusted to act properly. The second story is told by the Gemara after Yanai had conquered a number of cities and he had a big celebration and he wanted to show how great he was. So one of his advisors said, no, the Prushim don't really like you and they don't really respect you. But if you really want to gain respect, then I would suspect that I would suggest that you put the tzitz, you put the head plate of the Kohen Gadol on your head, and you take and you play the role of the Kohen Gadol by, as Irving Berlin might have put it, putting on the tzitz. So Yanai put the tzitz on his head, and this elicited a very strong statement from one of the rabbis who was present at the time. Hayasham Zaken Echad, there was a wise old rabbi there by the name of Yehuda ben Gedidia, and Yehuda ben Gedidia said, Yanai HaMelech, Rav Lecha Kesem Malchus, isn't it sufficient that you have the crown of the kingdom, that you have the political sovereignty? Hanach keser kehuna lezaro shel Aaron. Leave the Keser Kahuna, leave the crown of Kahuna for those who are the true descendants of Aaron. Yanai himself wasn't exactly a true descendant of Aaron, HaKohen, that's a separate story. But here too, what is being described by the Talmud is precisely this tension of the overlapping boundaries. And that is a recipe for a disaster when there is an intrusion from the political leadership upon the spiritual leadership and the spiritual well-being of the nation, or when there is a lack of respect on the part of the political leadership for the Torah system of law, which is exemplified in the other story by the Sanhedrin. And this danger and this pitfall applies even in these days. On the one hand, we have to be cognizant of the warning of both the Rav and by his son-in-law, Rav Yibadul Chaim Tovim, Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, that we don't have the power, nor is it even prudent nor wise, and Rav Aaron goes so far as to say it may not even be moral to engage in coercive authority with respect to religious legislation, even though it's important to preserve the Jewish character of the state by being officially Shomer Shabbos and by having a Rabbanut and so forth. Nonetheless, even though there can't be coercive authority, there still has to be a certain amount of autonomy which is given to the religious leaders. So when there is a conflict in this regard, for example, when the Knesset tries to pass legislation that would have religious consequences, this is how we see this tension playing out. If, for example, the Knesset, which is a political body, would pass legislation saying that Gerus conversions have to be performed a certain way, or that certain types of conversions, even if according to the religious leadership they're not valid, we're going to mandate that you accept them as valid, this is what presents problems. Or that we're going to define who is a Jew. David Ben-Gurion once wrote a letter to religious leaders in America about how he felt that if he had a couple that were not strictly speaking Jewish, but they wanted to adopt a child, or they gave birth to a child, and they wanted to raise that child in a fashion that would be in accordance with the ideals and the traditions of the Jewish state, so he wrote, "Can I just consider that child to be Jewish and just consider all of them to be Jewish?" That elicited a letter response from Rav Soloveitchik and Rav Chaim Heller. This is going back to the 1950s, in which they said, no, there's such a thing known as halacha. And part of the essence of the Jewish people, part of the essence of the Jewish state, is following Jewish law. And halacha says you're only Jewish if either your mother is Jewish or you go through some sort of a conversion process. This is something that we struggle with. There's the anomalous situation. I go almost every year, or many years I have gone, to Israel for a Dayanus conference. I'm planning to go in Yerz Hashem next week for a conference that brings together Dayanim from all over the world. And what we find absolutely mind-boggling is that in the Beis Din of the CRC, any case that comes in front of us, we have the ability to adjudicate. But the Rabbanut, which is the official arm, the rabbinic arm of the Israeli government, if parties would come in front of them and say, we want you to adjudicate a commercial dispute because we want to bring it to Beis Din as opposed to civil court, they're not allowed to. They're actually not allowed to adjudicate monetary disputes outside of the realm of their official jurisdiction relating to matters of marriage and divorce and personal status. Parties could go to some non-governmental Beis Din entity, some ad hoc Beis Din entity, and ask them to adjudicate as an arbitration tribunal, but the official courts of the Rabbanut are actually, by law, not allowed to adjudicate cases of that sort. So these types of tensions are very difficult to comprehend, to say the least. So what our goal has to be, I believe, is to create In this complicated climate in which we live, a respectful and cooperative partnership between the Melech and the Kahuna, between the crown of government and the crown of spiritual life, between religion and state. The lesson of Yanai HaMelech is that we have to be careful how we calibrate this cooperation, because if you push it too far, then people might get hurt. This is really not an exaggeration. It's something that we see. It's a very, very sensitive symbiosis that has to be created with sensitivity towards both sides. And finally, the last point that I'd just like to make, almost as an addendum, is that we've been speaking a lot about Rav Soloveitchik's views. I think in part that's because Rav Soloveitchik really was, at least in America, the spiritual and religious leader of the Mizrahi movement. He was the main spokesperson, he was the main orator, he was the main articulator of Mizrahi's philosophy. So the Rav felt that one has to also be careful, as with speaking about theocracy, for example, that one has to also be careful not to deify the state itself. The state itself should not be viewed as the be-all and end-all religious consideration to the exclusion of all other halachos. The Rav felt that living in the state of Israel, establishing a sovereignty in the state of Israel, having an appreciation towards HaKadosh Baruch Hu for the miracle of the state of Israel, were all important notions. But they're all important halakhic notions that have to be incorporated into the totality of halakhic existence. So, for example, the Rav quoted a story from his grandfather, Rav Chaim Brisker, in which one person was saying to Rav Chaim Brisker, well, we're suffering a lot here in Brisk, but at least, you know, if we knew that this was Chevle Mashiach, we knew that this was suffering that was going to definitely bring the Mashiach, then it would be well worth it. And Chaim Brisker said, no, why do you think it would be well worth it? That doesn't make it well worth it. I don't want to suffer at all. I want Mashiach without suffering. And the Rav said that just like Pikuach Nefesh, just like saving lives is Doche Kol HaMitzvah SheBetorah, that it overrides other mitzvahs of the Torah. So the Rav quoted Rav Chaim Brisker as saying, Pikuach Nefesh also overrides Mashiach. The only way the Mashiach's going to come is in order for lots of people to die. It's okay, Mashiach can wait a little longer. And the Rav was prepared to say that if the political experts, not everybody is so thrilled about this particular view of Rav Soloveitchik, but he felt that if the military and experts and the political experts who have a vote, as I said, we don't have a vote, we live outside of Israel, if those who are the experts who have a vote felt that Jewish lives could be saved by giving pieces of land away in Israel, so then he felt that it was perfectly appropriate. Because he said that it's also a mitzvah in the Torah. Part of the halakhos you have to bear in mind is making sure to save Jewish lives. And the state does not occupy a position, he said, that overrides every other halakhic consideration. So in conclusion, my feeling is that decisions need to be made in the state of Israel, and again, this is just a reflection, that truly preserve the spiritual essence of our people as well as our physical survival. There needs to be a spirit of mutual respect between the political leaders and the religious leaders, and it all has to be done with an aspiration of serving as an or la'amim in our ethical values towards all of Israel's residents, even as we preserve Israel as a Jewish state that is representative of our Torah traditions. And I'll just conclude by noting that I mentioned at the beginning of the talk that we're about to celebrate Hanukkah, and part of what we celebrate is the Jewish sovereignty in the state of Israel that was continued through the victory of the Hashmonaim. But what we sing in Maoz Tzur that represents the pinnacle of our celebration is Azig Mor B'Shir Mizmor Chanukas HaMizbeach. that the capstone of the celebration was the rededication of the altar. It was the sacrosanct nature of our spiritual survival, of our religious existence, of our ability to serve HaKadosh Baruch Hu on the holy altar. And the ability for us to preserve that holy altar in our homes, in our individual lives, and now with God's help and providence in the state of Israel, is what we truly celebrate and are thankful for. I want to wish everybody a Freilich and Chanukah.
Rabbi Reese will be willing to take some questions if anybody has.
Okay. Yes, please.
Light of the Rav last point about the distinction between the state and religious, and because that would say overcoming the needs of the state, etc. Does Yom Atzmaut in Rabbi Soloveitchik's opinion have any religious significance?
Very much so, and because Rav Soloveitchik felt that one of the major premises of his philosophy with respect to the state of Israel is that what happened in Israel was a true miracle, that it was God knocking on the door, that it was God showing us his affection and showing us his presence and his continued connection with the Jewish people, and that we had an obligation to reciprocate by showing our appreciation for the miracle that HaKadosh Baruch Hu had performed on our behalf. Yes?
As both someone who is both a Torah scholar and an attorney, both of serious stature, do you believe, and it sounds like this may have been the underpinning of what you were saying, that at least for right now, until Mashiach comes, that Israel is better served by having a clear separation almost between church and state, meaning that there's a democratic rule of law that applies to all citizens who are Israeli under whatever the definition of Israeli is, while Halacha and Torah exist as a separate function, recognized by Israel, but exist in their own strata and sphere, and the two shouldn't meet except where absolutely necessary.
I believe in preserving the Rabbanut and in preserving the religious institutions that currently exist in the state of Israel and the traditions that were established in order to recognize and to memorialize the Jewish nature and character of the state of Israel on a national level, such as, for example, having a national recognition of the sanctity of Shabbos, just to give one particular manifestation. However, at the same time, I'm also in agreement with the proposition that before that is expanded upon, what is necessary is more of an educational effort to reach out to those within the state of Israel who are not as religiously committed, so that there be a voluntary acceptance of a greater commitment towards Judaism, because I don't think that coercive measures ultimately will lead to a more meaningful spiritual existence for our people.
May I ask a follow-up question? So does that mean that you would have no problem with the proposition, which actually does occur in Israel? Part of the basic law in Israel is that every established municipality has the right to seek government funding for a Beit Knesset Merkazi, a central synagogue, and a mikvah. And there's talk in Israel, by the same law, in Arab villages, mosques, and whatever necessary religious edifices are built with public funds. And they're talking about expanding that. I know Jerusalem now gives out Christmas trees to its Catholic residents every year in December. Do you have a problem? Do you think it takes away from Israel's Jewishness that the government continues to do that as part of maintaining equanimity in its rule of law?
So let me go back to the first thing that I said, that since I'm not actually living in Israel, so it would be difficult to address the specifics of some of the legislation that's being currently proposed. But there really isn't necessarily a contradiction with Israel serving as a democratic state that gives equal access to all of its citizens, including Arab citizens, to resources of the state and certainly to educational facilities, while at the same time providing funds on a religious level for the building of synagogues and for religious education for whichever groups are being addressed, with the understanding that the fundamental national character of the state is Jewish in nature. Okay, yes.
I wonder if the rabbi could talk about the law of return, which implicitly gives special recognition to Jews versus non-Jews, because non-Jews aren't able to assert a right of return. So historically, how did this come about? Because it doesn't give recognition to halakhic status. There are non-halakhic Jews that are recognized and able to avail themselves of the right return. So, clarify that.
I'll say something which might be a little bit controversial. The longer you keep me here, the more likely I am to say things that are controversial. I'm not sure that it's such a good idea, speaking to Rabbi Eisenberg. My personal feeling is that there's no halakha per se that is intrinsically linked with the law of return. It's a political piece of legislation, and it can be interpreted and applied in any way in which the political legislators determine is most well advised. The question of how to define a Jew, how to define someone as Jewish, I believe, is a halakha question. I think that is something that has to be determined from the perspective of Jewish law. But if the Knesset decides that it's going to expand the law of return of granting citizenship to those who are not Jewish, that does not strike me as being intrinsically a halakha question. Yes?
I'm a little confused. If the Declaration of Independence of Israel says, mentions Medinat Yehudi so many times, what was the purpose of what? How does that differ from Prime Minister Netanyahu's law?
This would require an understanding of the political processes of the state of Israel, which nobody has been able to figure out for the past 66 years and counting. So that's not something which could easily be explained. From a logical perspective, that would seem to make a lot of sense. But then you get into the question of what really counts as law, what's really considered to be binding, what is the legal nature of the Declaration of Independence, to what degree does one branch have to accept the determinations of another branch of government in the state of Israel. And these are all very perplexing and vexing questions that are interpreted differently by different people at different times in different ways.
And on that note, thank you very, very much, Rabbi Reese. Thank you.